So connect up some of the activism that you've done around Palestine to, you know, the agitation that you've done this year surrounding the war in Iraq.
The issues, I think, are incredibly connected, but basically they both have to do with what is good for the United States and what is good for ordinary people, whether in the Middle East or in this country. And we started this group, Berkeley Stop the War Coalition, not actually this year, but we started it right after September 11th. September 14th, 2001 is when we started the Stop the War Coalition, because it was clear to lots of us on this campus that that a war was coming and that we needed to do something about it to show our opposition to a war. And we developed the slogan, don't turn tragedy into war. That was something that we came up with here at Berkeley. We were really trying to figure out these questions. And then the war in Afghanistan, I think, really got people thinking about what it was that the U.S. was doing. Now, the war in Iraq was, I think, much more politically a question on campus. More people were opposed to the war than were, opposed, I think, to any war that has happened this far. Before a war has happened internationally, the protests were enormous and all kinds of students were participating. You know, there were discussions in the dorm rooms about the war. You'd have like classes that were about history or about art or about, sociology would have breakout sessions to talk about the war and how it was affecting people. Literature classes would talk about the war. It really was a thing that everybody was talking about. And in that context, we were trying to organize on campus a group of people to really show that we could make a difference. And we organized for the day after the bombing started a big protest on this campus. And, the numbers, they're always debated in the press. The bombing in Iraq. And we got several thousand students to come out on Sproul Plaza to protest this war. And it was really quite exciting because despite Berkeley's reputation, like I said, it's a small minority of people who are involved in a political climate. But you really did get a sense that people were thinking about things, that people had opinions about these questions and wanted to do something to show their opposition. And, I think more students went to protests in San Francisco this year than probably in a really, really long time.
Yeah, I wanted to, go back and kind of, have you talk a little bit about, before, the protests that happened the day after the bombing started. I wanted you to, remind people what was going on in January, February, and March of 2003. And, the incredible climate of dissent and protest in San Francisco, particularly, but all around the country. Sure. Just kind of jog people's memory a little bit.
Sure. The thing that I think most people forget is that, November, December of last year, we were already thinking the war was imminent, right? There was all this discussion about how the troops had to go in during winter because it would be too hot in the summer. And so November, we were waiting for the war. December, we were waiting for the war. And it became like you were feeling like you're on a kind of, the edge of something serious. Like you always felt like the war was always about to start. And the thing that I think kept the war from starting in November and in December was the fact that we had these enormous protests, like hundreds of thousands of people came out January, February, March, right? Like there were protests of more, I think, bigger than people imagined, a quarter of a million in San Francisco against, against the war. Just like enormous protests. And the thing that was quite amazing about them was that it wasn't the kinds of people that, regularly come out to protest. It was parents and kids and high school students and people who hadn't been to protest since the 1960s, or at least they would say, as much at them. And it was just amazing. And I credit the anti-war movement with delaying the war that long, because all of the military advisors, and they may not have actually been ready in November, but the newspapers were all quite serious about the fact that if the U.S. didn't go in while it was still cold, it would be an impossible operation for the U.S. soldiers, and we really were able to delay this war for several months, and I also think we were able to do something which the Bush administration is now paying for, which is to force them to fight this war without any of the humanitarian rhetoric that they were talking about. It has now become, I think, absolutely transparent that this war is not about Iraqi liberation, that this war is not about humanitarian concerns, that that this war has everything to do with U.S. oil and has everything to do with U.S. control of the region. And it's also become increasingly clear that the United States government doesn't give a damn about what happens to soldiers, what happens to Iraqi civilians, and what happens in this country as, you know, the price of education is going up and the cost of healthcare are rising. And they just passed $87 billion for, you know, essentially for more military operations in Iraq. And that's what is quite, I think, becoming... It's one of the best things that the anti-war movement was able to do is to force the Bush administration to fight this war on our terms, had to say what the war was about, had to be as obvious as it was. And, you know, and I think, you know, all of the contracts that have gone to oil companies and to Halliburton and Bechtel have really, I think, exposed why the Bush administration was so keen on going to war when there was not a single weapon of mass destruction.
Okay, so on March 20th, the day after the bombing started, as, you know, bombs were falling in Iraq, as, you know, thousands of people were shutting down, you know, the downtown San Francisco area, as people were demonstrating all over the world. Describe a little bit about what happened here at UC Berkeley.
So we stayed up the night before. I mean, we had heard that the war had started, I think, the evening before. And so we'd stayed up most of the night making leaflets and posters. And then we got to campus at about 6 a.m. and we chalked all over campus, walk out on the war. We leafleted all the major buildings and the dorms. We had gone through the week before through all of the dorm rooms telling people that if the war were to happen, they should come out to Sproul Plaza at noon. And, you know, basically, we spent from 7 a.m. that morning till noon leafleting and talking to people about coming to Sproul and speaking and participating in the protests. And at noon, you know, like even as the noon bell was ringing, we were a little bit worried that the protest wasn't going to be all that big. But as people flooded out into the plaza, it was just amazing. From all the way from Bancroft and Telegraph to Southergate, it was just people. It was completely filled with people. And we had professors speak, faculty members speak, staff speak about their opposition to the war. And at about 1 o'clock, we led students who were participating in the protest into a sit-in in Sproul Hall. And, you know, hundreds of people sat in peacefully in Sproul Hall to protest not just the war in Iraq, but also what this university was doing, which was spying on international students, which was raising tuitions and laying off off-campus employees because of the war. And we knew that these things were absolutely connected to what was happening in Iraq. And it was just really, really incredible to see largely people who've never participated politically before take a active role in their opposition to what was going on.
Okay, I want to get back to this idea of, you know, spying on international students and also laying teachers off, because, you know, California is definitely, absolutely in, you know, an education crisis right now. Before we do that, I want to kind of get you to talk about, you know, some of the ramifications of what happened. A bunch of people were arrested in that day and in Wheeler Hall, along with
Sproul Hall.
Along with, you know, people from all over the you know, world were demonstrating, sitting down, doing civil disobedience. What happened again? You know, what were the ramifications here at UC Berkeley for the students?
So there must have been 300 or 400 students sitting in, but after a few hours, the university began arresting people, and 120 people were arrested. All of the criminal charges were dropped against everybody, but the university decided to pursue student conduct charges against 3 people, despite the fact that everyone had done the same thing, right? So everyone had sat in, everyone had been peaceful, there was no property destruction, no police were harmed, you know, it was an incredibly peaceful event. The university actually knew that the sit-in was going to happen before the sit-in happened. We had negotiated, like, the location of the sit-in and some of the logistics of the sit-in with the university beforehand. But the university has decided to pursue student conduct charges against 3 of the students, myself and Michael Smith and Rachel Otis, and is essentially punishing us for participating in nonviolent civil disobedience. It was really quite astonishing to me for a couple of reasons, not mostly because we had just walked up the Mario Savio steps before we walked into Sproul Hall. And, you know, if you walk around campus, you can see the Free Speech Movement Cafe and the Cesar Chavez Student Learning Center and the MLK Student Union. This campus is a way of commodifying political protests as opposed to actually supporting it. But what was genuinely shocking to me was that of all of the student protests that had happened throughout the United States that day, UC Berkeley was the only school that was charging students in this way. And that, to me, I think, gave lie to the fact that this is a liberal establishment, you know, full of radicals who are, you know, bent on critiquing U.S. policy. This university works like every other university across the country. Its mission is profits. Its interests have everything to do with, you know, making sure that business as usual continues. And while it entertains the idea of dissent, it's only a formal dissent that it appreciates. Any real challenge to the structures of power at this university are dealt with heavy-handedly. And that's, I think, become clear. It's always been clear to some of us, but it's, I think, becoming clear to more and more people as they see how this is actually playing itself out. And the thing, too, right, about the protest that's so fascinating to me is that the three of us who are being charged are being charged because we're the only ones with, you know, prior political convictions, which means essentially that 115 people also sat in who had never sat in before on this campus. And of, you know, the university is clearly hypocritical for going after the three of us, but we're incredibly proud of that fact, about the fact that, like, you know, we were able to put on a protest in which people were able to express their political dissent in this way and really, I mean, do the things that they wanted to do to show their dissent to this war. And that's really, I think, one of the most amazing things about that day. The university's reactions to it, I think, have been completely, I've already said heavy-handed, but completely blown out of proportion to what the protest was. And if you look at what had happened at sit-ins at other campuses, the universities there just decided to wait them out, and people left buildings peacefully. No arrests happened at San Francisco State or at other campuses where there were also sit-ins. This is the one place where they reacted heavy-handedly, and I think that it shows what the real interests of UC Berkeley really are when it comes to questions like politics and activism.
Okay, I definitely want to connect this up to kind of the greater climate about, you know, regarding activism on campuses. Before we do that, though, I just want to kind of touch on a couple of things about, you know, the ensuing months. First of all, you said that, you know, the three students were arrested and being prosecuted for activism or for, you know, demonstrating. But I wanted to, you know, my understanding is that yourself and the others were the other two that are now facing charges via the university administration were actually, you know, student leaders. And so out of the 120 students that were arrested, the people that are being, you know, are now facing administrative charges from the university really were the, you know, were people who were in a position to motivate people to express their dissent. Is that correct, or?
Well, we were definitely some of the leaders. I wouldn't say we were all of them. There were other leaders that were also a part of it. But it would have been clear to, I think, anyone. I led people in with a megaphone. Michael Smith was helping at the door. Rachel was, you know, helping to lead chants on the inside. It was really clear that we were part of organizing this thing. It also clear because Michael and I had sat down with the university in the days leading up to this protest to tell them what we intended to do, how we were organizing. We gave them copies of our flyers, and they knew about all of our meetings. They knew who we were. You know, I honestly believe that part of the reason they're going after us is that the political pressures that they faced to go after the Students for Justice in Palestine, they weren't able to pull off a conviction on Students for Justice in Palestine last year. And they really need to be able to show to the university's regents that they can handle protests on this campus. And I think that's why we're being made an example of. And especially, I think that the Daily California, the campus newspaper, said it best, which is basically that, you know, the university says that you have the right to protest on this campus formally, but you don't have the right to organize a protest on this campus. And if you organize a protest, they will punish you for it. And it's, you know, Yeah, it has everything to do, in our opinion, with the politics of this protest, the university's relationship to, you know, the financial crisis that's happening in California, and very much to the fact that this university is seen as where, you know, protest management activities get honed out nationally, right? I think Berkeley basically trains the rest of the world in how to deal with, or the rest of the country, maybe not the world, but the rest of the country in how to deal with political protests. And those kinds of things all get worked out at Berkeley. And if they're able to go after protesters here, I think it'll make it much easier for other schools to do the same thing.
Okay, and what are you facing? There's some pretty serious charges that you're looking at if you're, you know, convicted with this administrative charge. What has the process been like, and what are the charges? What are you facing?
Well, we're facing, the three of us are facing refusal to comply with university officials and disturbing the peace, which is, I think, the funniest of the charges, given that we were protesting the U.S. invasion of Iraq and students peacefully sitting in are being charged with disturbing the peace. But those are the things that we're being charged with. And one of us, Michael, is facing a semester-long suspension. And Rachel and I are facing 20 hours of community service if the university decides to sanction us to the fullest.
Okay, and the whole process, I also understand, has been fairly questionable on the UC level. Talk a little bit about, you know, the various hearings and what that experience has been like.
Well, the first hearing was mid-October, I think October 14th, and we were supposed to have enough time to put together a defense. The university basically gave us 8 days in order to put together a defense. Their argument was that we had, you know, 6 months of, you know, since the protest actually happened, to put together all these people. But we're not professional lawyers. We're students who are going to classes, and all of our witnesses are students going to classes. And that means that if we're going to get students to come to a hearing to testify about what happened, we've got to coordinate schedules. And, you know, some of the people have graduated. Others are out of the country on education abroad plans. We basically asked the university for extra time to be able to put on a defense, and they refused. And so we came to the hearing on October 14th hoping to negotiate extra time to put on an adequate defense, because we have a defense to put on about the way that, you know, the protest was organized and what actually happened. But they refused to hear it, and they convicted us without us being allowed to put on a defense. And they actually convicted us without us there. We walked out 15 minutes into the proceedings because we thought that they had already decided what they were going to do to us, and it was, you know, their decision to do it without, you know, if they were going to do it, they were not going to do it with us being a party to what was happening. So they convicted us without us there. And then in the sentencing hearing, we were able to pull together a couple of witnesses to come and speak, including Marsha G. Riley, who's, you know, one of the chief university administrators in the Office of Student Life, to talk about how it was an incredibly peaceful protest. And the university did know about it beforehand, and students should have the right to speak on campus and definitely shouldn't get suspended on campus. And I thought we put on a fairly decent defense. Now, we'd already been sentenced at this point, so it wasn't like we were able to contest, you know, even the merits of the charges. But some of the things that were pretty interesting to me were that the original package of charges that we had that we were facing, there were five charges. I don't remember all of them, but it was dropped down to two without us even there, which led me to believe anyway that the university was facing some pressure about this, that the people who had been emailing and calling the university about this case, and we had also gotten, you know, a full page ad in the Daily Californian with Howard Zinn and Noam Chomsky and Peter Camejo to write a letter on our behalf, we think, you know, had an effect on what the university is able to do to us, and we're incredibly grateful for all the support that we got. But it was quite clear that the university was going to make an example of us. And the best anecdote I have for that has to do with the student judicial affairs officer, Neil Raj Myra, who was a tyrant, to say the least, in the hearings, arrogant, obnoxious, unwilling to even, I think, the kinds of courtesies that students should be afforded. We weren't given copies of our files. We weren't given copies of the evidence, you know. And this was clearly our fault, because we should have known that we needed to ask for these things, not that he was, you know, required to hand these things over to us. The whole thing smacked of, you know, a kind of kangaroo court smear campaign that, you know, we knew we were walking in facing convictions, and, you know, as a consequence, we're now organizing against what the university has done from start to finish about, you know, trying us and convicting us.